Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 4:30 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 14th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, this is my second recording because a particularly inspired moment. I must have sat on the mute button for my microphone, and I recorded the first version of this audio with the completely silent microphone. So here we go again. So what I'd like to talk about primarily this week is the dollar, because I think it is the linchpin that is either going to break on the upside or we're going to see a collapse. And this is a bone of contention between a significant number of people. We have people like luminaries within the financial industry, such as Ray Dalio, Stanley Druckenmiller, Paul Tudor Jones, Paul Tudor, saying that the dollar is doomed and that it could fall in the region of 30 to 40% in the next crisis. Then you have the fact that a dollar or any currency does not fall in isolation. Against that background, if the dollar was going to fall by that much, you'd have to ask the question, it's a rational question, against what? Well, is that going to be against the euro? Well, the euro looks like it's under pressure here. Or the renminbi? Well, the last thing the Chinese want is a strong currency. So what is it going to be the yen? The Japanese are just about the only country that are still engaged in quantitative easing. So if we're going to have a massive dollar bear, what's it going to rally against? That's the big question. I'm reminded very acutely of one of the adages that David came up with years ago, which is that no country wants a strong currency, but some countries need a weaker currency more than others. Well, right now, the US dollar is among the strongest currencies for the simple reason that everywhere else appears to need a weaker currency right now more than the US does. That doesn't mean that the dollar can't go down in future, but right now the USA is the country that needs a weaker currency less than everyone else. That's why I've been quite bullish. Now there's another point, and I think an argument that Jeff Gundlach was going over, and it's something that I've seen quoted elsewhere, is that when we look at the dollar index, when it rallies, it tends to rally for about 3 years. When it declines, it tends to decline for about 7 or 8 years. So, for example, well, if we want to take back in 1978, it bottomed and then it peaked in 1985, so that was 7 years. If the bottom was here in 1992, then the peak was in 2002, that was almost 10 years on the upside. Well, the bottom was here in 2008, and now we're in 2018. People are starting to think that this is probably a peak for the dollar. And they have some historical precedent to base that prognostication on. And then, of course, people are pointing towards the fact that the USA is running twin deficits. So how on earth could that equate to a strong currency? That the pressure on government finances is eventually going to take a toll on something, and that something is likely to be the currency. So when you spend massively beyond your means, then the currency in which you're paying back your debts is likely to take a hit. That's a very rational argument. But of course, that is not a timing indicator. Eventually, these issues with the debt burden that the USA is taking on, the fact that they have adopted a pro-cyclical set of strategies, adopting a massive fiscal stimulus at a point when the economy was already growing, when there is already almost record low unemployment, is tantamount to encouraging a bubble, encouraging bubbly activity. So we know that when countries do attempt to impose or to abide by counter-cyclical policies, that the entire aim of that set of policies is to try and mitigate the big peak-to-trough swings, and sometimes it's even successful when you get economic downturns and upturns. But if you adopt pro-cyclical policies, well, then you're basically throwing out any hope of mitigating very large peak-to-trough swings and probably encouraging them. So I think there is a good argument that when the USA does eventually see growth rolling over, well, then that is something that is going to weigh on the currency in all likelihood. But let's then just simply look at the chart, because that's truth. Everything else is conjecture. So if we simply look at the just the weekly chart for the dollar index, we had a very important breakout in 2014. Prior to that, the index had been largely range-bound in what I consider to be a base formation between approximately 2008 and 2014. Then it broke out, and what this entire range, to me at least, looks like is a first step above the base. We had a failed upside break in 2016, and we had a failed downside break in 2018. Well, by the same token, that when you get a failed upside break, you're likely to go right down and test the lower side of the range. When you get a failed downside break, and especially on a dynamic basis, then you're likely to go back up and test the upper side of the range. Well, the upper side of the range is at 100, and the index is currently at 97. So the most likely scenario is that it is going to go back up and at least test the 100 level. But the one issue I have with looking at the dollar index as a measure of the value of the dollar is that it is almost 60% euro. It's 57.6% euro, 13.6% yen, and 11.9% British pound. And that's not particularly reflective of the world. It doesn't include the renminbi, for example. And that's a big omission. It doesn't include the Brazilian real or the Russian ruble and or the Saudi real. Of course, the Saudi real is pegged to the dollar. So how do you account for that in terms of the dollar's strength or weakness? Certainly, one of the arguments that is supportive of growth in the economy is the pullback that we've had in oil prices, and I will talk about that in a moment. But what I did want to bring to your attention was the performance of the U.S. trade-weighted broad dollar. And this is really making a nonsense of the argument that the dollar moves in these longer-term trends, or trends that last for only a few years. Because during the last significant bull market for U.S. equities, the dollar broke out in approximately 1981, and it rallied rather impressively all the way through. I don't know why that there it's gone again. I don't it rallied all the way through until 2002. So that tells us that the dollar is not exactly correlated with the stock market, that it kept rallying for an additional 2 years after the peak in the TMT bubble, but that it is in broad terms reasonably correlated. Now, this is on a trade-weighted basis. It doesn't really tell us about the performance of the dollar from day to day versus one individual currency. But on a big, broad, trade-weighted basis, the dollar is capable of secular bull markets. And after that peak in 2002, it trended downwards all the way through until 2011. And then it started to trend back up again. Well, on a trade-weighted basis, the dollar is now back at its peak from 2002. Now, This is not an index that is updated every day. It's updated once a week. But there is the potential here that the dollar could break on the upside, because there is, I think, something that is, I think, perhaps the most contrarian of all of ideas that are out there, that China is on the cusp of a recession. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that just because it's contrarian that it's correct. But China has got some significant problems. And when we think about that very simple maxim that some countries need a weaker currency more than others, China needs a weaker currency. And I don't think that that's a particularly arguable fact. When we look at the volatility that we've had in the renminbi, that it has had extraordinary moves in just the last couple of years, and now it is weakening again back up towards that 7 level. Well, it's a managed currency, and now the big question is, what are they going to do with it? China has got some very big ambitions. They feel that they have history on their side, and the one thing that I've heard more than anywhere else, and it tends to get on my nerves when I hear it, is that China has an uninterrupted history of over 5,000 years. But that completely ignores the fact that the Communist Party did absolutely everything in its power to completely erase Chinese culture. So then to use the argument that there's an uninterrupted history is rather facile. Well, the simple fact of the matter is that the Chinese have a clear objective to become the preeminent global superpower by 2030. And that is what the adoption of I guess there are a number of different strands to that. The first is, if you want to become a superpower, you have got to have an independent energy policy. So China is building nuclear reactors faster than anybody else, and they want to become the global center of the electric car market. Well, that's an objective because they want to try and export electric cars, but it's also a national security priority, considering how much money they spend every year on energy. Then, when you think about all of the additional commodities that they're importing, everything from coal to iron ore, they're spending upwards of $400 billion a year on that, and they would much prefer to have their commodity imports priced in renminbi. But the only way you could possibly have anybody accept renminbi is if there's a viable market for it. There's no point in taking it if you can't spend it. And that means that they would have to internationalize the currency. Well, the way that you internationalize a currency is that you make lots of it available, but then you lose control. And that's not something that communist administrations have got very much experience with. The last thing they want to do is to release control. Now, I thought it was rather interesting that when China had launched its oil contract, it had to back it up with gold. Some people thought of that as a sign of strength. But in fact, it's a sign of weakness, that if China was truly strong, then they would simply have backed it by the renminbi. But since people don't want renminbi to hold, then they had to back it with gold. So that's I think, a rather interesting prospect here. If China is really serious about becoming an international superpower, then they are going to have to float the currency. Now, one thing we can also see from this long-term chart is that it is definitely moving differently since about 2015 than it did prior to that. So they are definitely managing the currency lower, and they're trying to peg it to something. Well, they may be pegging it to the they're no longer pegging it to the dollar, but they're probably pegging it on a trade-weighted basis. Some people are thinking that they're pegging it to gold. Well, China is the biggest producer of gold, and gold prices have been steady, and they are right now in the region of the trend mean. The fact that gold prices have been so very steady against a background where the dollar has been moving higher in a modest manner is a testament to the fact that people are in need of some form of hedge against their exposure. So that is, I think, a rather important point. Now, one of the primary reasons that the dollar is firm, but not so firm, is because the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet. And this is a very meaningful move. There is only one other central bank that we have an example of which has removed liquidity on this scale previously, and that is the ECB. The ECB took €1 trillion out of circulation between 2012 and 2014, and that created deflation in Europe. So they had to come back in and adopt quantitative easing and add in 150% more than they took out. So that's, I think, something that we have to at least pay some due consideration to. That if the Federal Reserve has succeeds in removing over €1 trillion, that, or excuse me, $1 trillion, then the chances are that it is going to unleash some form of deflationary forces, and then they are going to be encouraged to come back into the market. Well, so far that has not yet happened because the US government stepped in and pretty seamlessly imposed a massive fiscal stimulus to make up for the loss of liquidity from the Fed reducing the size of its balance sheet. Well, the ECB this week stopped increasing the size of its balance sheet. And so far we've seen that the UK, France, and Italy within Europe have all adopted some form of fiscal stimulus. Well, obviously the UK is not in the Eurozone. Italy is getting a lot of blowback because of its deficits and acquiesced to the demands of the European Commission in here this week and said that they would only have a deficit of 2 point, I think it's 0.04%. And that resulted in their government bond yield starting to come back down. Well, of course, Italy has not said how they're going to spend the money, but the chances are that that's probably going to be enough for them to continue to enjoy the munificence of the ECB's buying in times of stress, regardless of whether they do in fact meet their budget or not. Whereas when you look at what's happening in France, then the simple fact is that French presidents do tend to acquiesce to violent protests in the street and give the people what they want. And generally speaking, what protesters in the street want more than anything else is more money. Well, that's definitely busting France's budget. And France is the country that has most often broken its budget commitments and very seldom gets any form of sanction from the powers that be. That is the true core of the Eurozone, the I guess the Paris-Berlin axis. But the simple fact of the matter is that the ECB is no longer adding liquidity. The European economy is under rather severe stress, and the stock market is starting to trend down. So that is telling us that not only have the European economies not really recovered, or perhaps more correctly, is that it took €2.6 trillion to undo the damage done by the withdrawal of €1 trillion. And we're pretty much back to zero right now. But the problem, of course, is that that was almost a 6 or 7 year period where millions of people in Europe have had lower standards of living and are now rebelling. So the rise of populist movements is a direct response to the failure of quantitative easing, which in turn was a failed set of strategies that dealt with the massive buildup of debt that's been going on now for almost 40 years. So this is a very, very big topic. This isn't something that's going to end well. That the fact is that globalization and technological innovation are sharply deflationary, but what they have in fact done is hollow out the middle ground. One of the things that I think is really not appreciated by the vast majority of people is that manufacturing jobs, generally speaking, pay well. That's the primary reason why they're the first sets of jobs to get moved overseas, because manufacturing has historically been the primary route for people with less education to achieve a middle-class lifestyle. So when those jobs were exported primarily to Asia, then what it left was a massive hole, and it basically knocked out the steps through which people could achieve a better standard of living. Well, what the kinds of jobs that have replaced manufacturing have generally been much lower paid. We're talking about jobs that are in the low-end services sector or in the tourism sector. And these jobs generally pay significantly less than manufacturing. So that means that there are still lots of people working, but that they have experienced a meaningful downgrade in their earning potential. So then you have the fact that technological innovation has increased so that it makes us feel like we're getting more with less. But the simple fact of the matter is that the phone in your hand is not the kind of thing that is going to help you to pay the bills. And the number of calls on our monthly income continues to increase, whether that is the mobile phone charge or the broadband charge, or indeed the fact that people are now employing that. Well, we can certainly see, for example, that people are buying fewer cars in the USA. They are adopting just using Uber and Lyft, and by doing that, they're saving money so that they don't have to pay for car payments or upkeep or petrol. But at the same time, that's really only the beginning of the trend. Technology is going to deliver increasing productivity gains in terms of transportation, but on the other side of the equation, that when you look at entertainment, that people are playing more computer games, and the way that you people, generally speaking, play computer games is that they engage in spending more money once you're inside the game. So that represents a draw on your income on a monthly basis. The number of bills that every household has to pay is increasing. So these are all factors that the subscription business model is proliferating. And whereas before you could have bought your computer and bought your Windows, now you're paying for Windows every month. So these are, I think, factors that are affecting people. That when you think about the revolt that is going on, that you're getting with one hand from technology, but it's taking with the other. And the jobs that would once have been able to fund that kind of spending are evaporating. So, or have evaporated a long time ago. Now, these are the integral parts behind this rise in populism. The natural response then, if we start to play the wheel forward, is that we're going to get more fiscal stimulus, because that's simply put what people are demanding. That does not necessarily mean that fiscal stimulus is the best solution, but it is the most likely solution. And Today we have the USA, the UK, France, Italy, and India are adopting fiscal stimulus. Now the big question is, what is China going to do? I saw these graphics in here today, and I thought I'd share them with you because China's industrial production is breaking down. The retail sales have been trending down since 2008. Fixed asset investment has been trending down since 2008. And property investment is just about still trending higher. So these are significant issues because when we look at the fact that China's banks, which I've maintained for the last 6 months, are enjoying a state-sponsored advance, well, they're just about holding the sequence of higher reaction lows, and they were down rather sharply in here today. China's banks have been the standout, and these are the state-owned banks. In fact, if we look at the global banking sector, then what we're presented with is a downtrend. And this is within the context of a long range, that the index has been in this base formation, and it is a supposition that this is in fact a base formation since 2009 and hasn't really been able to break out of it. Now, if we look at the constituents of the banks that are in this, these are all the significantly, excuse me, the systemically important financial institutions, the SIFIs. And you can see there you've got US banks, European banks, and Chinese banks. Well, I think everyone is familiar with the fact that European banks are still trending down, and that this index is no longer even a shade of what it was back in the early 2000s because so many of the banks have disappeared. Then, when we look at the FTSE 350 banking index, it's not looking much better. And it is also under pressure now and coming back down from the lower side of this range. Well, then let's look at the US banks. Because it is in the USA where we had the clearest evidence that the banks had been recapitalized, that they had to write off their bad loans. But even here, we've had a significant breakdown this week. So banks are starting to roll over. And the ECB has stopped its quantitative easing program, and the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet. The Bank of Japan is still adding liquidity, but the pace of that adding has moderated. And the People's Bank of China, if we look at their total assets, then the pace of that advance has also moderated, considering that it had really accelerated higher in 2008. The pace of its advance has moderated really quite considerably. Now, if we tote them all up and then rebalance it to US dollars, well, we're presented with a downtrend. And when we look at this over the course of this year, then the total assets of the major central banks peaked at 20.8 trillion in March, and they're currently at 1.45. Well, now think about the fact that the ECB withdrew 1 trillion euro in the space of about 2 years, and that did not have an effect on this index because the Federal Reserve was engaged in quantitative easing at the time, and so was Japan, and China was still stimulating. Whereas today, neither Japan nor China is engaged in stimulus, and the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet. So, with the ECB now stopping its quantitative easing program, we don't have a major central bank that is engaged in massive liquidity provision. And this index has contracted by 1.4 trillion in the space of 9 months. So that is more than double the pace with which liquidity was taken out by the ECB. If we're looking for just one causal factor behind the slowdown in global growth, the pressure that is coming to bear on asset prices, well, this is it. This is the reason why we're starting to see this happening. The other adage that I'm reminded of that David used to use at almost every chart seminar was that monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. So this is the really important chart. I was talking with one of the parents at my daughter's fencing club the other night, and he's a broker at Wells Fargo, and his opinion was that it was the trade war was the thing that everyone was talking to him about. But the trade war is a sideshow compared to monetary policy. The fact of the matter is that with the Federal Reserve reducing the size of its balance sheet, that represents a significant headwind to asset price inflation. In the same way that quantitative easing was wonderfully successful at inflating asset prices, then quantitative tightening is going to likely have the same effect on asset prices. Now, when we look at the Australian house prices, then it is we have to, I think, at least pay some consideration to the fact that Australia's house prices are starting to roll over, and the UK housing prices. I'm not sure I just picked the right index. No. But UK housing prices are also starting to roll over, and particularly in London. Then, if we have the Toronto property prices, I'm not sure we're going to get that. Let's just see how the REITs are doing, for example. They're all starting to roll over at the same time. So that's not something that's individual to their specific markets. The one thing they all share is that they all went up a lot, and that they are at historically high prices relative to median wages. But the much bigger point is that these were very desirable property markets, and they floated up on a sea of liquidity. Capital is both global and mobile, and it will flow to the regions that offer the best return or the best yield. And property has been a significant, or has enjoyed a significant tailwind from quantitative easing. The fact that you're getting commonality in the declines that we're starting to see in not only the housing markets but in the home builders, well, that's also reflective of this tightening of liquidity. Then, when we look at the mid-cap sectors, well, one might ask a simple question: is what is it that the mid-caps have got to do with the property market? Well, the simple fact is that they're both highly interest rate sensitive. Small companies borrow money in order to buy growth or to build out their companies, and that works wonderfully when credit is cheap. But when it starts to become less available or more expensive, generally both, then that starts to weigh on those indices, and the Russell 2000 is breaking on the downside. This is now the largest pullback we've seen since 2008, and that's not good news. That really is starting to suggest that things are looking kind of ropey here. But again, this is not individual to the USA. So, for example, when we look at the FTSE 250 in the UK, it has broken through the 18,000 level, and this is the biggest pullback we've seen. So, This wasn't a particularly consistent trend to begin with, but it's now had its biggest reaction. If we look at the MDAX in Germany, then we're presented with a similar story. This is an index that is now trending down. When we look at the small caps in Australia, sorry, this is the mid caps in Australia, then this index had been finding support in the region of the trend mean since 2012. Well, it's not doing that anymore. And it is oversold. There is no doubt that we have oversold conditions in a significant number of these markets, but they're leading on the downside. And that's because they're interest rate sensitive. Now, it's also worth highlighting that leaders lead for a reason, and they tend to lead in both directions. So, what was the reason? Well, mid-caps were among the best performing sectors, or asset classes, over the course of the last decade because of low interest rates. Now they're responding more acutely than other assets because interest rates are rising and liquidity is drying up. Then, if we look at, for example, the Japanese mid-caps, well, the second section is now trading below 7,000. The last time it did this, it bounced emphatically, and that was back in October. So, if it's going to bounce, then it would really need to start getting about it right now. And there is no denying the fact that the second section accelerated to the peak in January. So, if it doesn't bounce soon, then we're really talking about this is an evolving type 2 top formation. And that, generally speaking, a type 2 top is resolved with a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. So, if it doesn't bounce next week, then I think we really do have to hold on to our hats that Japan could be coming down in a dynamic manner. And the Nikkei is also right at the region of its lows. So these are, I think, very important. Now, if we also, I just want to look at the TSX small caps, just so that we can get a real good global perspective. And again, here is another index that is trending down. So banks are underperforming, and the interest rate sensitive sectors like small caps are underperforming. Then semiconductors have got the clearest evidence of a type 2 top with right-hand extension that I've seen in years, and these do look like it is going to break on the downside. So these are all, not only are they interest rate sensitive, but they generally tend to be leading indicators. The underperformance of banks is important, that banks are liquidity providers, and they should do well in a bull market because a bull market thrives on liquidity. If banks are underperforming, it tells us that there is a problem in liquidity. So, what is it that's going to make things better? Well, the Federal Reserve is meeting on Wednesday, and we're definitely getting some sell the rumor to potentially buy the news. And we have short-term oversold conditions, so then there is the potential that things could get better from Wednesday. But that is going to be contingent on the Federal Reserve getting more dovish, and not just a little more dovish. The reality is that it was a point that Jeff Gundlach made earlier this week in his webcast, was that every 200 billion in a reduction of in the Fed's balance sheet equates to about a quarter of 1% in terms of an interest rate hike. So even if the Federal Reserve raises interest rates and then goes on pause, but still shaves $600 billion off the size of its balance sheet next year, then that will equate to three interest rate hikes. And if that may not yet be enough to really arrest the decline that we're starting to see in asset prices. Generally speaking, central banks are responsible for more strife in the stock market than just about anything else. If, on the other hand, the Federal Reserve fails to raise interest rates and calls a pause on everything, then we could see a rally. But I rather think that the most likely scenario is that they are going to raise interest rates, have a pause, and then continue on the policy of reducing the size of the balance sheet. That does not answer the question of where the fuel for this, for the rest of, or the continuation of this bull market is going to come from. I think that's probably the most important thing to think about, that we are potentially now at a rather dangerous time in markets, because when we look at, for example, the Nasdaq, then it's right in the region of the lows that we had back in January, but it is below its trend mean. Now, if it continues to fail in the region of the trend mean, well, then we have to start talking about this as a downtrend. So this is a very important juncture, that if this is really quite different to what we saw back in 2015 and 2016. The one big difference was that, yes, the market did pull back below the trend mean, and then it bounced really very quickly afterwards. And the trend mean barely nudged. Well, the trend mean is now downwards. The volatility is bigger, and the size of the reactions is larger. And now it has pulled back very sharply from the region of the trend mean. That's a very big downward dynamic that we saw approximately 2 weeks ago. So there are very big questions being asked here, and the best case scenario is that this is the beginning of a range. But that doesn't mean that every sector is going to range. Those that are highly interest rate sensitive are those that are most dependent on access to liquidity are going to have the greatest pressure. There is certainly no coincidence that both Uber and Lyft are racing to IPO. One of the things that has been most important in helping to support asset prices over the course of the last decade has been buybacks and the number of shares that is actually still outstanding is quite small relative to what it has been historically. The number of companies that are in fact listed has declined. So by that standard, then we still have a supply inelasticity argument. But that's only appropriate when people aren't willing to hold cash. And the one asset that has done well this year is cash. So people are starting to think that it might be easier to simply hold cash than to accept the volatility that we have in asset prices. Then, when we think about the things that are likely to do well, the kinds of things that should do well are those that have got very steady cash flows. A lot of them will have adopted a subscription business model, particularly in the technology sector, and those that are very defensive in nature. The fact is that companies like the utilities are still above their respective trend means. The consumer staples are still reasonably steady. Need to type the correct ticker if I want to get the chart. Well, consumer staples are still above the trend mean, but have been easing back. But even here, we do have some evidence of trend inconsistency starting to come through. So when we look at, for example, Costco, it did accelerate into the peak that we had back about 3 months ago, and today it is breaking down below the trend mean. A company that I have looked at previously is Ruth Chris. It's one of our favorite haunts for big steaks, and it's not an especially cheap restaurant, but The pace of the advance definitely picked up at the beginning of this year. As soon as people found that they were getting tax cuts, they started to go out and spend them, and they started spending them at restaurants. So that represented a big boost for these kinds of companies, and now they're pulling back sharply. So that's suggesting that the bull market for Ruth Chris is over, but it's perhaps much better as a reflection of what people are actually doing with their money. Darden restaurants had just about been holding on until about Wednesday of this week, and then it broke below the trend mean. Now, it has so far held. So is it going to hold this $100 area? Because I suspect that this is going to be a very big psychological level. The other point that I've made previously is that the number of Rolls-Royce, Bentleys, Aston Martins, and both Ferraris and Lamborghinis I've seen on the street over the course of the last few months is completely out of character with what I've seen over the last 5 years here in Los Angeles. And when we look at, for example, Ferrari's share price, then it trended beautifully higher. Excuse me, must cough. It trended beautifully higher all the way through from 2016 to the middle of 2018. And now it's trending down. Well, that tells us that demand for highly expensive vehicles is moderating. People's if you're going out and buying a Ferrari, it's because you're pretty enthusiastic about the future. So when sales start to peak and to move downwards, well, that tells us in no uncertain terms that people are starting to get a little bit more are a little bit less enthusiastic about their futures. I think that's what this index or this measure is starting to tell us. So that brings us to the yield curve. And the yield curve has not inverted, but at least the 2 and 10 year part of the yield curve has not inverted. The 5 and 2 year part has. And this is a reliable lead indicator for recessions. It suggests that there is going to be a recession at some point within the next 18 months. That's also what the stock market is starting to tell us. Therefore, the one thing that would stop this from inverting and would really start to turn around the outlook for stock markets is a massive capital infusion. And it's unlikely that's going to come from the Fed. It's unlikely that the Europeans are going to do it right away, having just ended their quantitative easing program. So that holds out the prospect that it could be from China. And China's economy is slowing down. China has got a significant problem with its unlisted banking sector, that just about all the listed banks are state-owned. That's the really funny part, is that the listed banks in the public market are state-owned. The regional banks are not owned by the state. They are more owned by the regional governments. And a number of the regional governments are effectively insolvent. They are completely reliant on land sales. But that sets up a very unhealthy triumvirate or a between the banks, the government, and the property developers. Then you have the fact that there was a new story earlier on this week about an online portal for distressed property in China. I'm rather curious to know how long that's going to survive, because what it effectively is doing is creating a register of prices for distressed property. And it is going to create a price discovery mechanism for distressed property. That's something that is going to be very publicly available on the internet, and that's not something that the Chinese administration is going to be overly happy with. But what it does suggest is that there is a ready market evolving for distressed properties. And considering that China has 50 million vacant units, then there's a lot of distressed property out there. Or perhaps more correctly, there's a lot of potentially distressed property out there. So, if China were to engage in a large fiscal stimulus, then that is the kind of thing that could rescue the global economy. But the commonality that we're seeing in asset price deflation is a worrying sign. The underperformance of banks is a worrying sign. The underperformance of interest rate sensitive sectors is also a worrying sign. Well, then we have to question, why is it then that if all of these things are true, why aren't bonds rallying more? Well, it's hard for banks to rally more when there is such an enormous amount of supply that is scheduled for the market, and that has pretty much contained the uptrend in terms of the total return on bonds. But the one important thing here is that the total return on bonds moved to a new higher high in here this week. So that is beginning to suggest that bonds are starting to garner some interest from the investment community for the simple fact that they're the ones that have had a reasonable correction. The strategy that has worked best in terms of the entire bull market for bonds has been to buy the dips, and they've definitely had a dip. It's really only when the buy the dip strategy fails that people really start to have to reassess their participation with the market. And so far, the buy the dip strategy in bonds has not failed. Then, if we go back and look at the stock where people have been most rewarded for buying the dips, it's Amazon. And Amazon was down $66 in here today. So now the question is, having encountered resistance around $1,800 and it's holding the succession of lower rally highs since September, is the low around $1,400 going to hold, or are we going to get a higher reaction low? Amazon, I think, is the totem for this bull market. It's one of the most owned retail shares. So if Amazon does well, then I think the stock market will be able to muddle through. But if Amazon starts to really deteriorate from here, then that is going to represent a significant challenge. And there is no getting around the fact that Amazon doesn't make a lot of money. That it has a it certainly turns over a lot of money, but that the profits are pretty insignificant relative to the size of the company. And it's trading on a PE, and that's a forward PE of 80. That's pretty similar to the kind of PE that Netflix is trading on. And that's after Netflix has fallen about 40%. Netflix is another company that doesn't make any money and has a very heavy demand on additional liquidity because of all the new shows it has to continue to come up with. At least with Tesla, they don't have to come out with a new vehicle every 2 weeks. And the share is right in the region of the upper side of its range. It was not immune to the selling pressure we saw in here today. But Tesla may be the one company that can just about squeak past into profitability before liquidity dries up. That's, I think, and it has one big advantage relative to the vast majority of the rest of the global automotive sector, in that it already has a battery factory that is producing, whereas the rest of them have got to spend at least the next 2 or 3 years spending upwards of $100 billion cumulatively to build out the infrastructure for their batteries. So I don't really think that there's a lot of point talking about the big picture and the long term at the present moment. I think that there is that we are going to have to get over this liquidity tightening, that it is going to create some incredible buying opportunities, but that there is the risk that we're going to get a bigger pullback in interest rate sensitive sectors I guess over the course of the next few months and before we get the next round of infusion. I don't think anybody believes that central banks aren't going to ride to the rescue on this occasion again, and they have a significant number of additional tools that they have not yet employed. So that doesn't, I don't think it's wise to underestimate the resolve of central banks to deploy unconventional means. But what we can anticipate is that if they do go for an additional round of quantitative easing, that it's going to be larger than the last one. That's the lesson that we learned from Europe's experiment with reducing the size of its balance sheet a couple of years ago, and that we could see additional extraordinary measures deployed. So I think that I'll leave you with that for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.